I'm going to talk to you about a slightly different kind of focus than most of what we've heard about during this conference. Most of this conference is focused on direct services to trauma survivors themselves, and I'm going to be talking about the web applications in supporting the delivery of best practices for survivors by working with the provider communities and seeing what we might do to focus on that element of what's needed in a larger system of care. I'm Joe Ruzek. I'm the director of the Dissemination and Training Division of the National Center for PTSD, which is located in the Veterans Administration healthcare system in Palo Alto, California. And I have no conflicts of interest to declare as well. So I'm going to talk briefly about three different elements of what I think are going to be important for us to think about in using the web to influence the practitioner community. The first is simply information delivery and knowledge management in the field. The second is how we might begin to harness the web as a tool for training providers in evidence-based practices for PTSD and other trauma-related problems. And the third is thinking about what we're beginning to understand about dissemination science and what it takes to move the needle in provider behavior, because information and training alone do not change provider behavior in a substantial way, and there are a lot of other things that need to be done, which I think the web can be harnessed to facilitate. And please interrupt me as I'm going along. If you raise your hand, I'm happy to stop at any point and talk with you and answer questions. So we've talked a bit at this conference about using the web to deliver information, and I won't belabor these points, but it's widely recognized that the web has a lot of tremendous advantages as an information delivery system, particularly its informational capacity, its reach, and its, we hope, ways for presenting information that are more engaging and less passive and less static for our end users. But we've also seen in one of the presentations that currently the information that's being propagated on the web often has weaknesses. Bremner and colleagues in 2006 reviewed 80 internet sites that dealt with trauma-related information, and they found significant percentages of inaccurate content. 41% of them did not have a mental health professional in a development team, and they raised concerns that about inaccurate and even potentially harmful information going out to providers. Of course, we all know that many centers of excellence now exist in the field of PTSD and trauma, and there are many of them coming into being in many countries of the world, and in the United States there are many new research centers and education centers that are being created. And so there are websites that have, I think, a better chance of being relatively authoritative and having better quality information, although systems for monitoring and evaluating the quality information need to be developed better. I mentioned a couple of the National Center for PTSD, at which I'm affiliated, and the International Society for Traumatic Stress Studies. It's also true that most of the world's practice guidelines for PTSD are available online. The VA and the Department of Defense have collaborated to produce clinical practice guidelines for management of traumatic stress, and those are available online and currently being revised. And more, we're also going to be seeing ways of sending information about best practices to providers. So something that you may be interested in, the National Center for PTSD has something called the Clinician Trauma Update. If you go to this website, you can sign up, and once every month or so, I actually don't know how often they do it, I think it might be every couple of months, you will receive a mailing that will summarize the newest research findings that are very relevant to clinical care and talk about their clinical implications and just deliver it at your email address. The issue of information, though, is really much, much more broad. I think right now, let me ask you a question. What do you use the web for, and how central is the web for you in finding information? How many of you use the web weekly to locate information that helps you? What do you go to the web for? Shout it out.
Referral information for clients.
Great. Referral information is one source. What other type of information? What? PubMed. Yeah, PubMed to search for new articles. Yeah. Anything else? Drug information. Great. So there is a lot of information on the web that is useful for us as practitioners and researchers. But I believe that it's still not very well organized. Even in the best sites, you have to go and search, and you can't lay your hands very easily on what you need. So in the VA, I've been experimenting with trying to create a knowledge management website, one place that would be relevant for anybody in the VA that's treating PTSD or dealing with returnees from the Iraq War and Afghanistan wars. And we're calling it traumatic stress and readjustment, and it's only available on the VA intranet site, so people outside of the VA cannot see it. And part of the reason for that is it has the capacity for all of the providers to start discussion forums on any topic that they wish. And we are trying to find a way to unify providers and have them talk to one another. And so my hypothesis is that if we could assemble materials that are custom selected for our audience and are highly pragmatic, we may be able to gradually build in the web as an ongoing part of treatment services for our providers. The providers are very busy. They don't have a lot of time to noodle around and find sites and explore sites and look for various kinds of materials. You have to know you're going to some place that has a ton of stuff for you. Oh, that's useful. Oh, yeah, I really need that. Oh, I need that. So, for example, we have downloadable articles that are related to veterans and PTSD that are clinically relevant. We have patient education materials that they can pick up and pull and download, patient handouts and things like that. We have links to the major policy and strategic reports that have coming out of Washington that are relevant to the welfare of veterans. We have links to videos. We have links to online training materials with continuing education units where those are currently available. I think the most exciting development on the site is that various communities of practice now have their own subsites. So there is a subsite run by the National Center for Suicide Prevention, which has tons of suicide forums and information for people grappling with suicide. There's another one by the community of military sexual trauma providers within VA that has all sorts of specific information. The VA is currently disseminating two evidence-based treatments. One is prolonged exposure, and one is cognitive processing therapy. But we have pages for the community providers that have been trained in those initiatives, which has all kinds of downloadable materials, discussion forums, and so on. So I think that's going to be the future, is dedicated sites which are very pragmatic and extremely well organized for subsets of the practitioner community. It's a mistake to think of this in terms of information provision. We need to make the transition to thinking about knowledge management, because organizations and fields have knowledge, and that knowledge is many different kinds of information, and that's our asset. So we need to think about how to package, manipulate, and gather that knowledge as it's being developed and make it instantly transparent to the community who needs it. So that's part of our challenge. So we have informational resources that we've all been talking about here. The sobering reality is that providing people with information probably does about zero in terms of affecting their practice. And if we really see our challenge as beginning to change what practitioners do in the community in terms of changing their assessment practices, changing the types of treatment that they provide, updating their knowledge and enabling them to learn and absorb new interventions on a regular basis, then we're going to have to get way more sophisticated about doing that. Unfortunately, the research evidence on training suggests that when we disseminate written practice guidelines, it does almost nothing to change behavior. Reading a treatment manual can result in some improvement in clinician skills, but they're small and they're not likely to be maintained well. In fact, the major form of training that has been shown to affect skills and practice is very highly interactive, intensive, workshop-type style training, followed by ongoing supervision on a regular basis throughout an extended post-training period. And that's difficult to offer. And in fact, that's the real rate-limiting step in why we can't propagate the evidence-based practices. Now, the web, though, I think can be harnessed into training in a number of ways. It is nice because it gives practitioners a great deal of control over the process. They can select what they want and order it. We can assess their knowledge beforehand and match the training content to their knowledge. We can assign them to self-monitor their progress, which we know that that's a good tool for changing behavior. So if we can get practitioners to self-monitor, that's useful. We can identify the barriers and facilitators. We can ask them, you know, what are your attitudes about prolonged exposure? And then we can have web programming which addresses that. So, for example, recently our team developed a 22-minute video that is targeted at changing mental health provider attitudes about prolonged exposure therapy. And it features VA clinicians talking about their hesitations and concerns and then positive experiences in using the intervention. And it also interviews their patients who have been through the treatment, and the patients are talking about how it's changed their lives fundamentally. So we can stream that kind of material, and we can use this to change the receptivity to learning the evidence-based protocols that we need to teach. So a useful way of thinking about training and evidence-based practices is this, that there are two fundamental stages or components. The first is presenting didactic learning informational material and videotapes of treatment demonstrations. And the second would be having providers practice new methods under supervision. And the internet is a great tool for doing the first component. So what we can do is we can begin to take the demand off of the face-to-face training by outsourcing a range of training functions to the internet. This is very important because the face-to-face training is extremely expensive. And it's expensive for organizations that want to do it. It's expensive in trainer time, and it's expensive in the trainee time. So in the National Center for PTSD, I'm leading the national training initiatives in prolonged exposure. But it costs a great deal of money to do this. It's a 4-day intensive workshop followed by a mandatory 2 cases treated with PTSD under weekly telephone supervision. It costs, I have a budget for this year of $650,000 just to get people to the trainings. So, we're not going to be, we have to train people in dozens of things. So there's a limitation. So we have to use the web. The web can teach people conceptual models of treatment, procedures, and very importantly, we can model the key practitioner behaviors. One showing is worth 1,000 tellings. And I think this is a very good thing we can do using the web. And here's an example of a training that took place after 9/11 in New York for prolonged exposure. They were trying to get evidence-based treatments out to the community practitioners who were working with all the New York survivors after the World Trade Center attacks. And you can see the way they broke down the skills for prolonged exposure. Many of these are amenable to training via the web. Theoretical principles, procedural details, challenging therapist beliefs, overcoming therapist's initial reservations or observations, identifying barriers and trying to help them think through some of the structural barriers that would get in the way, motivating therapists to change their practice. And clinicians rated demonstrations as being extremely helpful for most of these skills, more helpful even than role plays. And we can put demonstrations on the web. Now, a colleague, Ken Ruggiero, pointed out to me, too, another, we need to think about web-based training as actually a variety of different options. One is preparation. We could show people web-based trainings before they go to a face-to-face training, and that might potentiate their knowledge development and their consolidation of what they're learning. We can do this as a standalone training. We can do it as a supplement to face-to-face training. We expect with Ken to be testing a large-scale online training in prolonged exposure as a post-training refresher course for people that have been through our national training initiatives in the VA. And Cohen and Manarino put this nicely. Provided in a convenient, affordable, timely manner that allows interested clinicians to adequately learn the model, return to the course as needed, ask questions, view examples, print out desired information for future use, and link to additional resources if desired. In other words, such a course would ideally allow learners to obtain everything they could from a live training, but do it cheaply, at a time that suits them, and without the expense or inconvenience of travel. And as an added benefit, they could return to the course for review as needed. So that's the benevolent view of what we might do with the web. There's a little bit of research on the actual effectiveness of web-based training. Isaac Marks and his teams in London have been comparing training in exposure therapy for phobia panic administered by tutors in face-to-face or administered by computer, and they've looked at students' knowledge, skills, and satisfaction and found no real differences there. Both training methods used. Now, you should look at this and you should be skeptical, because what we're showing is that knowledge and skills and satisfaction are equivalent. That doesn't mean that they're going and using these methods with their patients, and that's the gold standard. That's much harder to achieve. And that will probably require us to provide ongoing consultation and reminders and help to people as they make that transition to integrating what they learn into their practice. But computer-aided self-instruction saved almost all the preparation time and delivery for the expert teacher. So it's a huge resource that will not supplant face-to-face instruction, but it's a great supplement to it. Now, the model that you should go look at to see where web-based training is going right now, the Cadillac right now is web-delivered training in trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy. Actually, it's trauma-focused child behavior therapy. If you go on and do a search for TF-CBT, TF-CBT, you'll see this. And it's a 10-hour training in evidence-based treatment, which includes exposure for children who've been traumatized. And it's for professionals with master's degree or above, and it's a tremendous resource. It has all these different kinds of modules with video streams, tests of knowledge, description of the techniques, instructions, homework assignments, cultural, all this kind of package. This is what we're going to see more of now. Now, what's significant about it is these numbers are out of date, but you can see in the first year, 10,000 people almost registered for it. Actually, more than 30,000 have now completed this course, 10 hours, because it's offered free on the web to anyone in the world. And we're developing some of these kinds of online trainings. We're going to collaborate with Ken Ruggiero to develop this for prolonged exposure. I also have a research grant to develop smaller modular skill sets. We're targeting initially cognitive behavioral goal setting, motivation enhancement skills, and behavioral task assignment, giving homework and getting people to comply with homework. And we're doing a randomized controlled trial of training as usual, web-based training only, and web-based training plus 5 sessions of consultation across a 6-week period. And it's going to be aimed at VA mental health providers who deal with PTSD. And what's going to be very interesting, besides doing self-report, we're going to do simulated patient interviews where before and after the training, the therapists will be tasked to demonstrate their skills in these areas by interacting with one of our trained actors. And then we'll transcribe the conversations, and we'll look at whether or not the skills delivery is changing. So we have to do more research on web-based training to see whether or not it really can assist practitioners in learning evidence-based practices. Does pre-training and basic skills increase the efficiency of later training? Does it reduce the costs? What elements require coaching and feedback, and what can be done without that very expensive, difficult-to-arrange effort? And will different people respond differently? If we got people who've been trained in CBT already, generically, will they be able to pick up the new protocols much, much easier with less consultation and less support relative to people who have no CBT background, for example? So I've talked a little bit about information, and I've talked a little bit about training. But when we think about dissemination, it's really a much more complex enterprise. So the remaining minutes, I want to talk to you a little bit about dissemination and what are the tasks of dissemination and what the web might do. And I'm going to really highlight a number of possibilities that we can begin to use the web to do to support practitioners in delivering best practices. The first thing that's useful to do is realize that changing practitioner, like changing patient behavior, it's useful to think in terms of the stages of change model, the Prochaska and DiClementi stages of change. We have many practitioners who are in a stage of pre-contemplation. They don't even know that these evidence-based practices exist. Or if they know, they think they're the devil incarnate and they don't want to go anywhere near them because they don't like the fact that they control their behavior or it has a different theoretical orientation or something. Then we have people who are in a contemplation phase, that beginning to see all this evidence-based practice. Their organization kind of wants them to do it. They're starting to think about it. They're contemplating it. And there are some change tasks there to move them towards action. Then we have preparation and going through the training and then action and implementation. And then later, we need to maintain it. Now, all of those phases present us with dissemination challenges. And there are slightly different tasks that we might try to undertake at those phases. The web is gradually being harnessed for different aspects of this dissemination effort. So, for example, I found a study describing the development of a website which is aimed at targeting early steps in the adoption process. But it's a relatively passive information. It builds a commitment to try the interventions, and it has a lot of pages of information, treatment summaries, references, treatment manuals, links to training materials. And there are many of these kinds of materials are starting to be created. The Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration in the United States has identified evidence-based best practices, and you can go on there and get information about them. So those are designed to increase awareness and increase accessibility of training and learning about evidence-based practices. Another way in which the web could conceivably overcome some of the obstacles to using evidence-based practices is a more futuristic application, which we haven't seen yet, but I expect to emerge in the next few years. And that is one of the reasons people don't want to use evidence-based practices is because they're manualized and they have to do all of this stuff in sequence, and it reduces their control, their autonomy, and so on. But, in fact, evidence-based interventions are made up of modular components presenting a rationale, exposure, cognitive therapy elements, some ongoing self-monitoring, homework assignments, breathing retraining. You know, there are various modular elements which cut across all of the cognitive behavioral therapies. In fact, if you're interested in anxiety disorders, one of the new developments in anxiety disorders generally, David Barlow and others, are developing transdiagnostic anxiety disorder interventions in which they are identifying the core elements of efficacious interventions across anxiety disorders and then training practitioners in those skills. And then their belief and what they're beginning to test is that you can then take those skills, you can do it with social anxiety, obsessive compulsive disorder, PTSD, and so you have to train practitioners in a smaller group of skills which will enable them not to have to learn 20 different protocols. And this is especially important in PTSD where we have so many co-occurring problems. So that's been the thinking that's driving my developing the web-based trainings in the way I am. But what we can do on the web is we could have components, manualized components of these different skills that a practitioner could drag and drop and assemble into their own treatment manual in an individualized way for a patient, so that they would have a certain amount of choice over which subcomponents of the tools available that they felt were a match with their own clients. So this would have the advantage of giving them more choice and flexibility, which is overcomes some of the barriers to manualized treatment, at the same time as retaining the evidence-based elements which are responsible for positive outcomes. And I expect we will see the web coming to facilitate the delivery of that kind of modular treatment capability in the future. Another way in which the web can help at a larger systems view is we have very poor ways of identifying best practices, especially as they are emerging. What we have right now is we have different organizations that look at evidence-based treatment, but they typically revise these things once every 5 years. And organizations themselves, for example, the VA or the Department of Defense or a hospital or the city of Zagreb, don't have a very good way of finding out what are the best new emerging practices or what are the things they should do. It's very time-intensive and difficult to identify those practices. We don't get this information. We don't get the information that we need from practitioners and patients about what's wrong, what's not working, what their attitudes are. And the web can, I think, help us with this. The web could, in principle, help us capture emerging best practices, find ways of communicating what are the best services, survey practitioners in terms of what they need and want, what their obstacles are, so that teams could develop interventions around those things and develop things that the practitioners actually want. We also know from dissemination science research that even good quality training and consultation is not effective in training practice in most cases. You also need to look at the larger systems issues that get in the way of practitioners delivering interventions. So, for example, in disseminating prolonged exposure in the VA, there are systems barriers. One of the systems barriers is you're not supposed to see a client for 90 minutes. You can't go longer than 80 minutes. The protocol doesn't fit. Another one is that there are a lot of patients, and a lot of patients are on long-term maintenance. They're being seen once a month because they are very difficult to work with, but they clutter up the caseload of the providers. So the providers can't get time on their busy schedules to do an intervention which is going to take 9 to 15, 90-minute sessions. So you have to think through and work with the program managers about how to redesign the clinics and restructure what their offerings are in order to enable practitioners to do this. So, and also research and dissemination science says that you should, before you disseminate a practice, go into the organization or the agency and put certain things in readiness. You know, you have to look at what the barriers and facilitators are to change. You have to make sure that leadership is supporting it, that they will support the practitioners having the time for the training and all that, that they're going to create the systems that would allow us to follow up with the practitioners. So we can do a lot in the web. We can establish the dialogue with the leaders. We can put on checklists of actions to get ready for the interventions. And I think very importantly, one of the big themes of dissemination is you have to be talking to your audience as you're moving forward through all phases of the initiative. One of the predictors of successful dissemination is having the consumers, who in our cases are mental health professionals, buy into the process, feel like they're part of the, they're heard and they're part of the decision-making process. The web can help with that. Another way in which the web could help is to foster something called learning collaboratives. So learning collaboratives are ways of harnessing the authority chain to facilitate the delivery of new practices. So what learning collaboratives do is you pull together the clinicians that you, a sample of clinicians you want to learn the new intervention, whatever it is, you pull together their managers, you pull together their administrators, and you get all the stakeholders, representation from all the stakeholder groups that are possible, that are important to this initiative in one way or the other. You pull them together and get them all trained. Then they all go out and try and intervene, and then they come back periodically and talk about the adaptations they've made, the obstacles. So there's rapid learning from all the key audiences, and then that's recycled over time. This is, I think, a very clever way of getting many of the obstacles to dissemination addressed simultaneously and rapidly. So the web can facilitate the operation of these learning collaboratives. We also can put in place a lot of technological support for the delivery of evidence-based treatment. So we're going to be developing these materials for prolonged exposure. So for prolonged, clinicians could download cheat sheets, which remind them what to do in session one. So it's just easy for them to have it in front of them. It helps them adhere to the protocol. The VA is setting up structured progress note templates for prolonged exposure. So you can go in, fill it out. It has all the relevant things that, again, helps you adhere and helps your reporting. We can set up systems for patients to go on and create their in vivo exposure hierarchies online. They can do homework online, and that can facilitate the communication and take the burden off of the provider in many ways. We've heard at this conference about evidence-based treatment programs that can be used by our patients in anxiety disorders, for example. And I think the future of care in mental health is going to be a partnership between the provider, the PTSD patient, and the web. And so we're going to, when we're teaching an evidence-based treatment, we're going to say, please watch this installment, and it's going to explain the rationale for prolonged exposure. It's going to do it better than we ever could, because it'll have videos of patients talking about their experience. It'll really help them. The best example, I think, of the future comes from a study by Isaac Marks in London again. And they had developed evidence-based web interventions for different kinds of anxiety disorders. And they set up a whole clinic that used this. And in the clinic, the people with obsessive-compulsive disorder, depression, phobia and panic, and general anxiety would come in. They would meet with a nurse. The nurse would show them how to use the program. They would be assigned to go back and use these programs. They would be contacted 6 times by telephone throughout the duration of the treatment just to make sure that they keep working through the program. And they got mean effect sizes of 0.8 or more. And the key thing is they were able to see 355 people, whereas if they were doing it face-to-face, they would have seen 50 people. Now, this is very important, especially if we can build web programs that are very, very interesting. So routine clinical tasks can be performed by the computer. Many evidence-based protocols are largely didactic. That could be farmed out to the web. But I also have a hypothesis that no one's really talked about yet. And I think that as practitioners begin to use these web programs, I think the web programs are going to influence and train the practitioners in the protocols so that they're going to see their clients improving. They're going to have to read it in order to orient their patients. And I think it's going to be a stealth training method for the providers in evidence-based protocols. The web also is a very important tool for measurement. Particularly if we look at dissemination of evidence-based practices, we need to know what's going on. Right now, think about it. We don't know anything about it. Have you ever seen any good numbers on what practitioners are doing in your sectors? We don't gather that information. We ought to be gathering that information on a regular basis as a way of figuring out what we need to change, but also as a metric for exploring whether our impact is happening in changing practices. I'm at the end of time. Then finally, I just want to say I've mentioned this, but I want to belabor this point a little bit. And that is most dissemination efforts right now are top-down. A bunch of academic experts get together and decide that certain treatments are good, and then they try to get the providers to do it. I'm doing that inside the VA. So it's not that that's a bad thing, but it's likely not to be an effective thing. For a couple of reasons. One is we need to get the buy-in. The other thing is it's like if you were a mental health treatment provider and somebody comes to you with PTSD and you don't do an assessment to find out what their problems are or what they want to work with. You just say, well, I have this, and you give it to them. What we ought to be doing with practitioners is finding out what they want and need and helping respond to those needs. We would have much greater receptiveness. And that would also set the scene for us to do some top-down where, you know, we think that certain interventions are important. But even as the evidence in dissemination is interesting. We have two competing ideas in dissemination of evidence-based practices. The idea that comes from treatment outcome research is we need to set up clear systems for ensuring adherence to the protocols in order to maximize the impact. And there's evidence that that's very, very important. But the evidence from dissemination science literature says that if you want practitioners to adopt new innovations, you have to give them the ability to adapt those interventions to fit their own environments. and then are far more likely. So we have two opposing ideologies that are a problem. We need to figure out what are the muscular components of interventions that must be done, and what are the things that are window dressing that are less important. So I think that the web will be part of how we dialogue with practitioners about this process. So I've tried to talk about the web as information, but more broadly thinking of that as knowledge management for the field. The web as a training tool and how it can supplement face-to-face training and make us more efficient in disseminating best practices. And I've also tried to show you that dissemination is really a very large set of activities that's needed to accomplish fundamental change in services, and that the web can probably be harnessed and will be harnessed as we move forward for a variety of different elements of that. This is going to be a new change, because getting practitioners to use the web is going to mean that we have to have the right stuff on the web. Many of you raise your hands, but most clinicians don't go onto the web a lot because what's on the web is too hard to find and it's not that relevant to the nuts and bolts of what they need to do. So I hope I've stimulated you to think about that. We have 10 minutes for questions and comments and discussion with Dean and I. Thank you. So did I talk too much and...
You were talking about practitioners and how to engage them in the culture and the drivers to get them to engage in evidence-based practice. But what about the consumer push to the ways in which providers are going to have to do the provision of new forms of intervention? I just wondered if you could speak to that.
You're right, and that's really, really important. So one of the things we're doing inside the VA is I mentioned we made a video that was targeted at the practitioners. This year we're making a video that's targeted at the patients, that's going to explain and show patients who have been through prolonged exposure. It's a little bit like Bandura's coping models, right? Share their concerns about starting prolonged exposure, but then how it worked and how it had an outcome. We'll explicitly choose, you know, a young Iraq war person, a chronic Vietnam veteran, a military sexual trauma survivor. We'll try to get a range of models. And our idea is to get that into all of the clinics as part of their patient orientation materials. And I think that that's going to create demand, for example, for prolonged exposure. So, I think that as these websites are developed that talk about in persuasive ways evidence-based practices, we can expect that Anxiety Disorder Association of America, other Vietnam veterans consumer groups, and patient groups of all kinds will start asking for these treatments and start complaining if they're not available. Now, that does suggest to me that we're really going to have to work on explaining and developing a good dialogue and persuasion capability for the patient audiences. Because, you know, one of the things that's in some ways wrong with the mental health treatment outcome field is that the outcomes are often developed by some researcher someplace that has studied CBT or something. He or she developed the outcome, and then they take it out in the field. I would argue that we ought to, in the very beginning when we're developing it, we ought to take it to our providers and to our patients and get their input, just in the same way we get the outcome information in pilot testing. I think the websites are doing that, right? Some of the prevention websites and other websites are having dialogue with consumers. Nancy, you talked about, you know, running this by various audiences in the design phase. But I need to think more about how to engage the customers in the process of both designing and marketing and evolving evidence-based practices. So I think you're right. And I'm thinking a lot about the providers, but the truth is you may be right. What may actually drive it is the demand from the people that it's designed for. And it also might fit better with their lives if we get their voices into the process early. Do you have thoughts on that you'd want to add?
I don't know about PTSD or even within VA departments, but certainly in Australia it's very difficult to engage practitioners in doing guided assistance to the use of quite a few very good websites that we have in Australia. So a lot of people have tried for a long time of identifying the barriers, which are very clear in private general practice, and sort of thrown their hands up in horror and said, okay, let's go straight to the person. So I don't know. It's just an interesting
I think
way.
It'll be, I would guess it'll be a generational change. You know, it'll be something that takes 10 or 15 years to begin to mobilize people. I think that, you know, what I think is paradoxical about this is that it really could conceivably save provider time and increase their effectiveness. So, you know, there's a whole literature on dissemination, you know, showing that perceived advantage is important of innovations. And so I think the field is also wrestling now with how do we change providers, and there are a lot more concepts coming into play. Whether that's going to make us a lot better, I don't know. I think the successful dissemination initiatives are characterized by a whole lot of very systematic effort that's expensive and that goes on for a long time. And I don't know if we're going to be able to design different systems. I think our concept of what a mental health practitioner is outmoded. You know, I think the old model is we go to school, we train in some graduate program, and then we do that for the next 30 years. And we go to continuing education, which doesn't really do anything. But probably we need practitioners that are really adaptive practitioners that are picking up new things, trying new things. And I don't know how we're going to create that workforce. I think what I see is that a lot of the younger people coming into the helping professions in psychology, for example, are already thinking that way and are much more receptive. So inside the VA, I think we actually see a kind of generational change taking place. And then the preponderance, you start to get a critical mass of opinion leaders that are doing different things. And so I hope we can accelerate it, but, you know, maybe it's going to be very slow. Other comments and thoughts about all this and about how the web could be useful for you? Or
well, this is very quick because I think we're probably running out of time, but I'm thinking about the practitioners and the kind of work that you're doing, they're doing, can be very draining, very, very draining. So I'm thinking about self-care, peer support, and whether there could be a way to build in forms, chat, email exchanges, whereby practitioners can be talking to each other, communicating via the web about the work they're doing, what's working, what isn't working, how they're coping, how they're managing. You know, that kind of stuff.
I think that's a very smart idea. So that might be something that the providers want. When I used to think years ago about setting up a website for early intervention in hospital trauma centers, I thought, well, you know what we'll do? We'll develop all these great materials, but we'll also develop a parallel site that's on the same site for emergency room nurses and professionals that will be all about self-care with CEUs and all this stuff. Because my perception was they were interested in self-care. So they come there and you're doing all this stuff that you get CEUs for. And then, oh, there's other stuff there. So I do think that that's a very good idea. And I think the other thing that's been starting slowly to begin to think about is the concept of provider support. You know, I mean, in a way, I'm beginning to think there ought to be a support person for every 100 providers whose job it is to be a point of contact for those providers and facilitate their functioning. Because we'd get better effects out of it. But we right now what's happening is continuing education is being driven out, learning is being driven out, time for innovation is being driven out, systems are starting to count what providers do, and it's actually becoming less fulfilling. So there's a lot in what you say, and I think that might be part of the way that we win hearts and minds and establish good dialogues with people. Time, I think, for one last comment or question for Dean or I.
Maybe this is bridging a little bit between both, thinking broader than mental health practitioners and thinking more prevention. I think we need to think about providers like nurses and others and to really get these, particularly prevention, whether it's broad mental health prevention or prevention of traumatic stress after an event. There simply aren't enough mental health practitioners in the world to do that work, and we need to be thinking about nurses and healthcare providers and police officers and all the other folks who come in contact with people and what we can do you know, sort of the notion of trauma-informed service systems and of other systems of care. And I think the web has a big place for that as well. And we need to think hard about what are the really basic things we'd like folks to learn, because they do have their other jobs. Yep. You know, we want doctors to save people's lives first before they do the support. We want teachers to teach math and reading, but and police officers to do their thing. But how do we build in some trauma-informed things? I think the web has a place for that sort of training as well.
This sort of comprehensive knowledge management thing, I'm talking about PTSD providers, but really the same thing should be there for police and for, you know, the physiotherapists who go into the homes. They all have different things that they need to add to their repertoire. And so their own kind of knowledge management issues would be different. But I think that this will come, you know, but we have to figure out how to build them, and I hope that PTSD might be a leader in this. Okay, well, thank you very much for the discussion.
Oh, you think so? Oh,